You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome back to a new week full of piping hot days, Monday to Friday, served up just for you.
Fresh, never frozen. Fresh.
Yes, easy peasy, fresh and squeezy.
never frozen.
Easy peasy, lemon squeezy, that's it.
There you go.
Yeah, so anyway, sorry, I was... It's all taking me back to this hilariously uncomfortable British comedy show.
Okay.
British humor does discomfort, exquisite discomfort, better than anybody else.
Okay. I have to ask which British discomfort show is we talking
about. I couldn't tell you. It's a clip that I've seen that's hilarious of apparently like... British governmental officials working together with the U.S. in the ramp up to the war in Iraq.
And, oh my, that's a setup.
And somebody, one member of the British government is talking to another one, and they're supposed to tell the Americans that, no, this war is not going to be a cakewalk. And anyway, somebody from the British government casually says, it'll be easy peasy lemon squeezy. And then the other guy goes, no, it will be difficult lemon difficult. And that's the message that the guy has to deliver to the Americans. And so there's just this exquisitely uncomfortable moment in this big crowded room full of American politicos and military brass and British brass and all of this, and this guy turns to them all. They ask him for his view, and he says, we have a saying in England, difficult. It's just
I like so, it
a great
I'm a gonna great I'm gonna demo. Adopt it, there you go.
So that was pretty good.
We have a phrase in our house for when things are difficult, which is that you're building a fabuki, which is a reference to a World War II ship that the Japanese built, where there was too large a scale and too small a displacement. And that when I start to take over on too much, my husband will gently say, fabuki.
Fabuki. That's a new one on me. I have not heard that one.
We've also got a sub that we built, a model sub, the USS Nautilus, which my husband built to explain to the children that if they were bad, they would get on the USS Nautilus at Christmas time. So he would hand them the sub.
Okay. Well,
so you're on the Nautilus, on the naughty list. There you go.
That's worth knowing.
Useful vernacular for understanding the Antonetti household.
Things I've never heard, you know. It's hard to take in. So, well, how's it going?
It's going very well. It's last week before Holy Week, and we're getting through what we call birthday palooza. At our third birthday in 4 weeks.
You got a lot of spring kids.
2 March and 2 April and 1 May. So every 2 weeks we all get right. Cake. So not good for my diet, but a lot of fun.
Me and my brothers and practically everybody in my family are all late summer kids. Which, you know, tells you how Shays spend their winter night. And so
Oh. And your parents love you.
It's not a bad way to spend a winter night. Huh?
No.
But yeah, so my mom was born in March because she like stuck out. Everybody was born in March. And my wife's family are all winter babies. They're all like November, December, including my wife. And we've got one kid that was born. He was born 2 days after his mother's birthday. So we always say that he was, you know, he's 2 days younger than
there you
Jan.
Go.
And I'm not sure how we got there, but
well, I mean, we're talking about you asked how my weekend was, and we had a birthday.
Oh, okay, oh, that's it. Okay, being fruitful and multiplying.
A 15-year-old's birthday was April Fool's Day. So, really? Yes. So
it's got to be fun to have a birthday on April Fool's Day. I mean,
well, it was also Easter Monday when she was born. So she better and better. No, we.
I'm going to say that was 15 years ago.
That was 15 years ago.
How about
yes,
that? Yeah.
There you go. And you did the math because I said she was 15. But anyway, but she was 2 months premature. So that was her April Fool's joke on us was to come 2 months early. Yeah. Surprise.
My brothers were both born July 19th, 3 years apart. One was in 46 and the other was in 49.
That's cool.
It's cool. So they had the same birthday. And when I came along unexpectedly 9 years later, after my next oldest brother, they were like crossing their fingers. They wanted me to be born July 19th and just complete the trifecta.
There you go. That would have been kind of cool, too.
Yeah, but it turned out I just overshot the mark, and I was born August 5th. But when I did come, I did not screw around. My parents lived 20 minutes away from Providence Hospital in Everett, Washington. This is before there was a freeway, mind you, back during the Eisenhower years, before they had passed the what was called the National Defense Transportation Act. The way you got everything passed through Congress in the late 50s was you turned it into this defense issue. The Russians are getting ahead of us. And so we need an interstate system or the Ruskies will beat us. We must not lose the interstate system gap, Mr. President. And so that's how Eisenhower got the interstate system put through was we have to have an interstate system because the Ruskies are going to beat us. Well, they hadn't built that interstate system. And I lived at that moment at 2 o'clock in the morning on August 5th, 1958, living in my mom's womb.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay, I'm ready.
Ding, the little timer popped out and we're good to go.
So my mom like sat bolt upright in bed and said, it's time.
Straight out of one of those movies, yes.
Yeah, so they bustled out to the car and zoomed away and got to the hospital. And the nurse apparently took one look at my mom and said, oh, can you hold on? And threw in this wheelchair and just like took off in a dead run down the corridor with my mom. So my dad is like, this is back in the day when men were not there for this.
Yes.
You were doing the proper manly thing of filling out the paperwork and then you waited until
smoking
some doctor
and sitting and watching the clock. Yeah, yes.
Yeah. So my dad goes in to get everybody checked in and he's like, still working on the paperwork. And the nurse comes out like 2 minutes later and says, congratulations, it's a boy. And my dad is like looking around the waiting room and there's nobody else there. He's going, wait, are you talking to me? Yes, it's a boy. Oh, okay. So he finished filling out the paperwork and then just wrote mark down in the slot because that seemed like a good idea at 2:20 in the morning.
Mm-hmm. And thus Mark Shea came into the world.
And thus, literally, Mark Shea was born.
Yes, and there you go.
Yeah, that's
cool
that's
story.
One of those weird things. Yeah, apparently my mom went into shock because I came so fast, so...
Yikes.
She was trembling and stuff. And
Yeah, well, that sometimes happens with that sort of thing. So I came early because we were down in Texas and the barbecue smelled good. And so it sounded like there was a party going on. And so I figured, hey, so I'm supposed to be born September. September is boring. I'm going to be born July 3rd. So there you go.
Okay.
So
you're like right before the 4th of July. Well, that's not bad, is it?
Oh, it's awesome. It meant I went fishing almost every birthday for like the first 18 years of my life.
Okay.
You know, spent the whole day fishing and then barbecue, and it was great. Chocolate cake, fireworks are for me. Dad always had off. It was great.
That's really great. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm a big fan of the whole 4th of July thing. We have a my brother lives on a lake down near Olympia, Washington, which is the capital of our state. And so for a long time, we used to go down there, and my brother is a sax player and a clarinet player who played with this big band, the Johnny Lewis Band. And they would play these gigs all over Olympia and stuff. And so the whole band would show up and set up on the lawn. And then they would do two, hour long sets of big band music.
Oh, how awesome.
And you would like get out in the lake and float in your, approved flotation device and eat spare ribs and listen to Take the A Train, and it was just fantastic.
Oh yeah, that sounds
what a great awesome way to spend the 4th of July.
Yeah, we spent it playing guitar and eating hot dogs on the beach.
That's
also
fine. Yeah, I agree. Hey, you're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm host Mark Shea, and we will be back with Sherry Antonetti, and we're going to be talking about yesterday's readings right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots, where, with the rest of America, I and Sherry Antonetti are on the edge of our seats waiting for that giraffe that's somewhere to have a baby giraffe, because that's the thing that is apparently the thing that everybody cares about today. So there's a giraffe somewhere in a zoo that's pregnant and theoretically, allegedly, at some point is right about to give birth.
Well, it's, captured the imagination of the internet the same way that dress that changes colors.
Yes, exactly. See, that's what I was saying. What they need to do is they need to, when the giraffe is born, assuming that this isn't like a hysterical pregnancy or perhaps a giraffe welfare mom trying to when you think about it, giraffes do nothing in our zoos, do nothing but sponge off the state, don't they? What work do they do? Nothing.
And they aren't even really on the food chain because lions don't want to go near them because they might get kicked.
That's right. So the only thing that they put out, and they put it out in tremendous quantities, is a lot of rose garden fertilizer. You know, here's a story.
There you go.
That you need to hear because it's super important. There used to be, and maybe still is, at the Woodland Park Zoo here in Seattle, one of the best zoos in the world, actually. Not as great as the San Diego Zoo, but way up there. They used to have the Zoodoo Hotline. And the Zoodoo Hotline was really quite epic. The guy that worked at the zoo in charge of Zoodoo used to make these fantastic recordings that were just epic. You would call in. First time I called him, I was just expecting, you have reached the Woodland Park Zoo Zoodoo Hotline. Like you'd get.
Please
right?
order but, your poo so that
but
you can.
No, you called in and you get this like the opening music to Star Trek and this guy's voice echoing on your phone saying, Zudu, the final frontier. It was really fantastic.
Oh, wow.
So one year, my mom was an inveterate gardener. So one year for Mother's Day, what I did was I went and I got giant, hefty trash bags, just full, not merely of poop. You can get that anywhere. Chicken right. poop, you know. No, this was Zudu. We're talking elephant and hippo and, of course, giraffe poop.
Yes, this is quality exotic animal poop.
It was cool, yeah. So I brought this. Here, Mom.
I brought you bags full of excrement.
And she was like, oh, thank you. She was so happy. So we went out and planted roses. Excuse me. It was fantastic. So, yeah.
That's awesome. That is awesome. We've used zoo poo before ourselves from the National Zoo. But before the break, we were talking about 4th of July celebrations and memories of being out on the water and floating in inner tubes. And you reminded me of that when I was a kid, we would go floating down the Guadalupe after camp. Because camp was in the highlands of Texas. And, you know, we would rent an inner tube and link up and float down, and it was very fun and lazy. But there were people who were, I would call them, expert or professional river floaters, because they would bring the cooler in an inner tube by itself. And one time we saw there's this chain of people. And they had an inner tube and it had a cooler in it. And the woman next to it, she, without batting an eye, she took her foot and she opened the cooler with her foot. Now, that was impressive. Then she reaches in with her toes and pulls out a beer, a can of beer. That is more impressive. And we're all watching at this point because this is sort of surreal. She pops open the lid with her toe. And we just kind of just started applauding because we knew there was nothing more you could do. That you have to be committed to that sort of laziness to get that kind of a feat. It was just that impressive. But you reminded me a lot of that with the floating with the ribs.
Well, you know, I look at a spectacle like that, and it's hard for me to make up my mind if that is the hardest working or laziest person I have ever seen. You know,
it's very Catholic. It's both and.
I mean, I guess, you know, once you master the skill, and that's got to be the fruit of like years of practice, right? Yes. I mean, how do you do that?
You know, what if you pop it open and then drop it with your toes? That would be like awful. You know?
I just can't imagine how something like that would be done, you know, with your. It seems like if you can grab the beer with your feet, why not just at that point just pass it up to your hands where it would be so much easier?
Well, you know, you have to sit there and think, if you're listening out there, I'm sure you're sitting there looking at your Diet Coke can and going, now, if I use my big toe, oh, please make sure you're up to speed on your tetanus shots before attempting this at home.
It's just that's spectacular. Well, you know, and now, of course, I'm faced with a problem. And the problem is, how do we segue from opening a beer with your feet to the Sunday readings?
I don't know.
I'm just going to work without a clutch and say, you know, speaking of opening beer with your feet.
That reminds me of the Sunday's Gospels. Here we go.
You know, how about those things? So,
speaking of really neat tricks.
Son of man, can these bones live it up? How's that? That seems like it's a segue.
Ta-da! Okay, yes. I'm going to probably have to go to penance for that one. Okay.
So, this is just making the biblical text relevant. So anyway, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Sunday readings because, you know, the Lenten readings are super interesting. What always interests me are the combinations of readings that the church picks. So we talked last week about you know, you've got the story of the man born blind.
Yes.
And oddly, there are lots of things that you could link to in the Old Testament. So you could, you know, you could link to something obvious, like Isaiah talking about, you know, in the age of Messiah, the lame shall walk and the blind will see. That would be obvious, you know. Okay, Isaiah said, when the Messiah comes, the blind will see. Look, this blind guy can see. That's an obvious prelude to the story of the man born blind. But instead, the Old Testament reading the church picked was the story of David being chosen. And, you know, David, the runt of the litter, and yes. And this whole really quite remarkable discussion of David's appearance, which is incredibly rare in Scripture. Scripture almost never gives us physical descriptions of things. These are not people who are writing a modern novel and going into tons of detail about, you know, how somebody looked and et cetera, et cetera. Biblical writers don't care about that, except in this one curious place.
Yes.
And what's really interesting is that just before we get this detailed description of how handsome David was and his beautiful eyes and all the rest of it.
Splendid appearance, yada yada.
It's putting in a splendid appearance. Just before you get all that, the biblical author says, God does not look on the outward appearance.
Yes.
Yeah. And so it's a really intriguing reading. And so we talked about that last week. And if you're interested in hearing that discussion, go to the Podbean archives for Connecting the Dots. And you can go back and listen to us a week ago. You can travel back to the thrilling days of yesteryear and hear that discussion. But today we've got the discussion of in the Old Testament, or on Sunday, that is, rather, in the Old Testament, you have the very conclusion of one of the great prophetic visions in the Old Testament, the Valley of the Dry Bones.
Yes.
Which, by the way, is the basis for one of the great Negro spirituals of all time. Them bones, them bones, them dry yes. bones.
Yes.
All we got in the readings yesterday was just the tail end of this vision, which I think is a shame. I wish that they had read the whole thing, because it's one of the coolest pieces of visionary literature in the Old Testament. Ezekiel is full of cool imagery. And Ezekiel does weird, crazy things, too. So the background on Ezekiel is he's called an exilic prophet, a prophet of the exile. So for hundreds of years, the prophets come to both Israel and Judah and warn them. Israel and Judah are what result from the civil war that happened after Solomon died.
Yes.
And so 10 tribes go north to form the kingdom of Israel, and a couple of rump tribes go south and form the kingdom of Judah. And we'll talk more about that when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Antonetti, and we're talking about the Sunday readings, and we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Sherry Antonetti. We're talking about the read from Sunday.
Yes. Which
are super interesting. I want to give just some background on the Ezekiel reading. We kind of got gypped, I thought, by the Old Testament reading, because you only get the very end. And just to give some background on who Ezekiel is. So there are pre-exilic prophets and exilic prophets and post-exilic prophets.
What does exilic mean? I'm sorry, I'm not...
Exilic means that they're exhilarating. No, that's not what it actually means. It means before, during, and after the exile to Babylon.
Thank you, because I was feeling really stupid if it did mean exhilarating.
No. So what happens is the prophets, David reigns about 1,000 BC, just about exactly 1,000 years before Jesus.
Right.
And then his son comes along, and then once Solomon dies, Solomon's dumbbell son Rehoboam takes over, and Rehoboam is the big man on campus. He's a young guy who has decided that he's smarter than everybody in the world, and he surrounds himself with all of his buddies from college who all tell him, "You are freaking awesome. And don't let anybody tell you any different. And if your subjects give you any guff, just treat them like slaves and show them who's boss." And so he's like, "Yeah, I'm awesome." So the elders of Israel, the guys who had advised Solomon and who had been around for David, go to Rehoboam and say, "Be nice to your subjects. Don't treat them. Don't act like Pharaoh, because that's happened before and it didn't end well." And so Rehoboam, turns to his college buddies and they tell him, "Yeah, I don't pay any attention to those old guys. They don't know."
So he turns to his Twitter feed and starts.
Twitter feed, exactly. "What should I do?" And so he listens to all the young dumbbells who think they know everything. And the result is a civil war that tears Israel apart, never, ever, ever to be rejoined. And so the 10 tribes of Israel break away from the Davidic kingdom. And a couple of tribes, Judah and Ephraim, stay loyal to the house of David. And
gotcha.
Because the house of David is from the tribe of Judah. And things don't go well after that. So the Northern Kingdom, the Northern Kingdom is faced with something along the lines of what the United States was faced with after the American Revolution. Because up until the American Revolution, the official church in the New World was the Church of England. Well, that won't do at all once you're no longer English.
Yeah, we kind of need to start over here. Okay.
So that's where the Episcopalian Church came from, was, well, we need to have a church that's still basically the Church of England, but not calling the King of England the head of your church, because that's really weird, right?
Yes.
And so the Northern Kingdom of Israel found itself in a similar situation. You can't very well have a separate country, but then have your people all going to Jerusalem, which is right in the middle of the kingdom of Judah.
Awkward.
To go celebrate your sacrifices. So they set up their own shrine in Bethel. And guess what they put in that shrine?
What did they put in that shrine?
They put golden calves in that shrine and said, "These are your gods, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt."
Okay, so if you
resonances here, that's the problem. And so Israel instantly apostatizes and never, ever returns. And so the prophets go both to Israel and to Judah saying, this is not going well. You really should return to the covenant, because if you don't, something bad's going to happen. And Israel ignores and ignores and ignores. And this goes on for 300 years until finally the Assyrian kingdom, who were sort of the Nazis of the ancient world. The Assyrians were not nice people. You can find like Assyrian bas-relief art. They like bas-relief stuff. And so, and it tends to feature a lot of scenes of hunting and fighting and killing.
Fun.
And there's one particularly memorable Assyrian scene of the king reclining at leisure with his queen. So the king is, you know, laying comfortably on this divan.
Yes.
And the queen is seated at his side in her royal chair. And they're drinking wine out of these bowls. And this seems like a pleasant scene until you start looking at the decor of the room.
You pan away and...
you pan away from... the central figures, and of course they're surrounded by courtiers and sycophants and so forth, but the interior decoration of the room,
yes,
is severed human heads.
Lovely.
That was how Assyrians, you know, then
that was their modern deco. Okay.
Yeah. So
I have seven heads in my courtroom. How many have you got?
So. Later, post-exilic prophets, some of the shorter ones, the little itty-bitty ones that a lot of people don't ever read, like Nahum and Obadiah, are basically little poems written to celebrate the destruction of the Assyrian Empire and just gloating. And that's all it is. It's just, everyone hates you guys, and we're all glad that you're dying, you know?
Oh, wow.
That's really it, right? So, anyway, after Israel, the northern kingdom, gets wiped out, the prophets then focus on all that's left, which is the southern kingdom of Judah. And they do promise restoration to the northern kingdom, but the main focus that they turn to is the southern kingdom of Judah, and they start saying, you know, shape up, because if you don't, then you're going to be sent into exile, and the temple's going to be destroyed. The temple is not indestructible. Don't imagine that it is, because it was consecrated to God, because if you don't keep the covenant, then God will abandon the temple, and it's going to be wiped out, and Jerusalem will be, you know, razed to the ground, and it'll be really bad. And so the southern kingdom goes on for a while, a couple more centuries, and then eventually Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the Babylonians, does what the prophets had warned was going to happen, and he attacks Jerusalem and sacks the southern kingdom and deports them all to Babylon. And so this is what's known as the Babylonian captivity. Yes. And so all those prophets that happened before that are called the pre-exilic prophets. And then you start getting exilic prophets, prophets who go into exile along with their people. And Ezekiel is chief among these. And so Ezekiel is prophesying at the darkest period in Jewish history, arguably until the Holocaust. And he is saying incredibly, he turns to them at just the exact worst moment in their history and says, things are going to be fine. It's going to work out. Don't worry. God has got this. And we're going back to the promised land, and we're going to rebuild Jerusalem. It's going to be fantastic. And the prophets always have the task of saying weird things that don't make any sense at the time, you know?
Yeah, so they all have the Cassandra complex. They're going to tell you what's true, but no one's going to believe you.
Nobody believes them. And so, although, of course, these are words of encouragement, which are much nicer to hear than shape up or, you know, destruction.
All is lost, yes.
And so Ezekiel has various things that he's told to do, and all kinds of strange visions and things like this. So it's Ezekiel who is instructed by God to lay on his side naked next to a little model of the city of Jerusalem. This is before the sack of Jerusalem, and say, you know, just as I'm, you know, surrounding this little model of the city of Jerusalem, this is what the armies of Nebuchadnezzar are going to do, which I'm sure, you know, people at the time thought that that
okay.
was a weird.
Yeah.
But at any rate, he's given this promise at one point. He's given this vision, which we'll talk about when we get back, of the Valley of the Dry Bones. And the Valley of the Dry Bones is what it's the very tail end of this that we heard in the Sunday readings yes. yesterday. So the music is about to come blasting in, so I will not tell you about the Valley of the Dry Bones. But when we return, I will tell you about the Valley of the Dry Bones. So we'll be back on Redbox Media with Sherry Antonetti right after this.
Okay.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to Connect the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. So we're talking about Ezekiel. So Ezekiel has this vision. He has a number of visions, but he has this one spectacular vision in which he finds himself in the midst of a valley, and it's full of bones. And they're not just bones. They're dry bones. They've been out there since forever. Like
been bleached by the desert sun, and they're just, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is, these...
These bones are dead bones. They're not slightly alive bones.
Bereft of life. This is an ex person.
Yes.
And you know, it's this is as dead as it gets, and there's no coming back from this in any normal sense of the word. And so God says, "Son of man, can these bones live?" And the prophet, being smart, says, oh, Lord God, you know, I don't know. So he's told prophesy to these bones. And then there's this rattling sound and the bones come together. And then God performs essentially a recreation event. So, you know, here's this.
Sinew and flesh and skin.
Yeah, sinew and flesh and all the rest comes over these bones.
But no breath.
And then, right, and then God breathes the breath of life into them, his spirit, and they stand up. And then God tells Ezekiel the point of all this, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. That means, by the way, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom.
Yes.
And so this is a promise of national restoration to a people who have just been beaten down into the dirt. For decades, they've been beaten down into the dirt. And so that's the literal sense of that vision. And it's not surprisingly, this is the prelude that the church uses to introduce the story of the raising of Lazarus. There's a couple of interesting things, I think, about the story of the raising of Lazarus. We've mentioned, I think, on the show in the past, the significance of names in the New Testament that
yes.
Names have tremendous importance in the Hebrew tradition anyway, because names tell who you are. They have a kind of a, I don't know, revelatory power about them. And so when you change somebody's name, that's a big deal. So when Jacob gets his name changed to Israel, that is revealing something hugely important about him. He who struggles with God is what Israel means. And so it's a big deal that Jesus is named Jesus, because that name means the Lord is salvation. Well, what's interesting about is Lazarus is that Lazarus happens to share in common something with the one and only character in a parable who ever gets named by Jesus. Jesus normally just, you know, tells parables about anonymous people. There was once a man who had two sons. There was a woman who lost a coin.
Right.
Because he's not a novel writer. That's not what this is about. He's not telling us fiction, precisely. He's using this kind of parabolic language.
There was a Pharisee and a tax collector in the temple. Yes. Okay.
Right, right. And so we don't need to know their names. We just, you know. And yet, fascinatingly, in the entire length and breadth of the parabolic tradition of Jesus's teaching, we have one parable in which a character is named, and it's the parable of Lazarus
the beggar, yes.
And oddly enough, it's a story about a guy who dies and has a whole conversation in the afterlife with somebody who is saying, ultimately, well, man, you know, please, Abraham, send somebody back from the... Let me come back from the dead.
Yeah, so I can warn them so that they don't want to hear.
My brothers, right? And so it's like, what an odd coincidence that there would be a story about resurrection, a parable with resurrection as the theme, starring somebody named Lazarus. It's almost like too weird a coincidence to be a coincidence, you know?
Do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
And this is just a private opinion of mine, of course, but there has to have been a particular time, of course, that Jesus told that parable. When might he have told that parable? Well, I think, because we know from other parables that Jesus does do this. He tells parables that have topical references. So he tells the parable of king that goes to see an emperor and try and claim his kingdom from the emperor, and the delegation goes after him and gripes to the emperor and tries to stop him from getting that. Well, that's a political reference to something that actually happened. Herod had actually done that.
Okay.
And so he incorporates this kind of topical reference into one of his parables. Well, what better time to tell a story like the story of Lazarus and the rich man than at the big dinner that's thrown to celebrate the resurrection of Lazarus? And I am morally certain that was probably the occasion upon which this particular parable was told, because it would have been, among other things, hilarious.
I think that sounds fun to imagine anyway.
But why is it combined with this story of Ezekiel? Well, because, as Jesus said to his disciples in the Emmaus Road, everything that's written in the Old Testament is really about Jesus. And so this imagery of national resurrection, how does resurrection happen ultimately for the nation of Israel? The nation of Israel is still, in the time of Jesus, scattered to the four winds. The 10 lost tribes are still very lost. How do we get them back? Well, what the prophets say is that when Messiah comes, that then the Messiah will gather Israel to himself. How does that happen? It happens not by Israel returning to the Holy Land, but by the church going out to all the nations where the 10 lost tribes have gone. and proclaiming the gospel. Here's an interesting factoid for you. Rodney Stark, a sociologist here at the University of Washington, has looked at the population of the ancient Roman Empire, and particularly the Jewish population of the ancient Roman Empire. At the beginning of the Christian era, there are about 6 million Jews scattered across the empire. Most of them were not in the Holy Land. Most of them were in the diaspora. About five centuries later, the population of Jews in the empire is about 1 million. What happened to the 5 million? Well, they didn't die. They became Christians. And that's interesting because it winds up being exactly the fulfillment that the prophets are looking for. And so all of that ties together, of course, with this picture then of Lazarus, because what Lazarus is a foreshadow. He looks backward to, among other things, things like the Valley of the Dry Bones vision. But he also looks forward to what's about to happen in the resurrection. And it's interesting that when John introduces Lazarus, he mentions that he was the brother of Mary.
Oops, yes. And Martha, yes.
And what's fascinating is that he says Mary was the one who anointed Jesus.
Yes.
And he mentions that a paragraph or a chapter before he tells the story of the anointing. Why does he do that? He does it because everybody knows who Mary is. Wherever the gospel is proclaimed, this woman's story will be told, says Jesus.
Yes.
And why does she anoint him? She anoints him for his burial.
Yes.
And so this whole scene with Lazarus is a foretaste and a foreshadow of what's just about to happen in the far greater resurrection that Jesus is going to accomplish. So there you go. That's what's going on in those readings.
Well, I just, you know, I love that whole story because there's so much drama in it. I mean, like the Mary and Martha interaction with, you know, that Mary's still waiting and comes later and she makes the same, not quite accusation, but statement to Jesus. If you'd been here, he'd be alive.
Right.
And I love that the interaction of the sisters with Jesus, because they're kind of on parallel level at that point. They're both professing belief in him and both wishing he'd been there.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
I don't know if you've, the one thing I would say is I love that story, if only because my father went and got to walk down into the tomb that's in the Holy Lands. And it's very narrow and it's very dark. And it's very amazing to go down into it and feel how real it is.
Well, I envy his chance to do that. I wonder if I'll ever get to do that someday. That's cool. Well, I want to thank you, Sherry Antonetti, for being on the show today. Our producer today was Mr. Danny Head. And I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we'll be back tomorrow with our special guest, John Mark and Teresa Grody. Yes, the son of Marcus Grody of the Coming Home Network. Until then, have a wonderful evening. Bye-bye.
Sounds fun. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.